This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The first deep-sea hydrothermal vent was discovered in 1977. To the surprise of virtually everyone, these undersea hot springs, where superheated water and gases spew out of cracks in the seafloor, aren't desolate or barren. Quite the contrary, they are now known to be rich oases of microbial and animal life. In fact, hydrothermal vents have become a leading candidate for the place where all life on Earth originated. Jill McDermott is a PhD candidate in the MIT Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Joint Program in Oceanography. She was part of the team that discovered the deepest known hydrothermal vents, and also one of three authors of a recent study casting doubt on the idea that life began in the deep sea. Jill McDermott joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks so much.
Now, let's talk about these deepest hydrothermal vents. They're on the what's called the Mid-Cayman Rise in the Caribbean. Where are they and how deep are they?
Well, they are located just to the west of Cuba, just southwest in the Caribbean Sea. And what is unique and what intrigued us about Cayman is that the rock type here is not like the rocks that are most commonly found at the bottom of the ocean. We actually have these older types of rocks that have been exhumed or brought up from deeper in Earth's crust. And the depths in the Cayman Rise are down to about 6 kilometers depth, whereas average ocean depth is only about half that deep.
So what, in having this different kind of rock, how would that make these hydrothermal vents potentially different from hydrothermal vents at, say, 3 kilometers of depth in other parts of the ocean?
The different type of rock that we see at Cayman is actually more similar to types of rocks that would have erupted on the very early Earth environment when the Earth contained more heat. And so we were looking at Cayman as some kind of an analog for an early Earth environment. So what were the conditions like then? And can we find a place like that exists now on our Earth?
Now, as I understand it, there had been some doubt about whether or not hydrothermal vents, as we know them in other parts of the ocean, could actually exist at those depths. Why would they not be able to?
It was more of a question of heat, whether or not there's enough heat to sustain hydrothermal venting. And in an environment like Cayman, we only have an eruption maybe once every 10,000 years. And so for many years, scientists thought, well, perhaps there aren't as many vents there, or they're very rare. But what we've come to find out is it looks like these kind of very old hydrothermal systems where the forces are actually more tectonic, so there are big fractures forming in the Earth's crust, and these systems are more efficient at mining heat than we had first thought. And because they're more efficient, then it does turn out there are hydrothermal vent systems there as well.
So one of the vents that you guys actually ended up not just finding one, but finding two, and one of them is actually now the deepest that we know, and also possibly the hottest. So it's not that these were going to be too cool. They're in fact, one of them is actually, we think, the hottest?
Yeah, that's true. The deeper vent is called the Picard vent field, and this was hypothesized potentially to be one of the hottest vents that we could find, and that's due to the impact of pressure. As it turns out, the pressure is actually sets the upper temperature limit for a fluid, for an aqueous fluid to reach. And because we thought these vents may be at such high pressures, we also thought this might enable them to reach higher temperatures than we'd previously observed, due to the high depth. As it turns out, these vents approach 400 degrees Celsius. That's 750 degrees Fahrenheit. So they are very hot. It didn't actually break the record, not the measured temperature. But we do have chemical evidence that the vents were, in fact, hotter at depth while they were circulating through the crust. They were very hot, and that imparts a special chemistry to these vents.
So does the life at these very deep vents and potentially very, very hot vents look different, or is it largely the same kinds of life that you see at other vent fields?
Well, both, actually. The life that we observe at Cayman is actually, it was brand new. So one of the kind of fun things about working in hydrothermal systems is almost every organism is new to science, or it's a relative to another organism that we've seen before, but actually itself is new. And that was also true at Cayman. We have a team led by Cindy Lee Vandover at Duke, who's working on the biology in the system, but they are new. We did see shrimp, which is also what we see observe in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge as well. And so one of the interesting questions there is, how are these shrimp related, and how, you know, at what point in Earth's history did that transition occur, either from the Atlantic to the Cayman or the other way?
And also, how do they get from one of these vents to another? Because they're very few and far between.
Yes, the conductivity question is really interesting.
Well, with them being few and far between, how do you actually go about searching for one of these? I mean, how large is a vent when you find it? And how much area do you have to cover? And how do you cover it to actually find a new vent?
Well, the Cayman story is great for this because I got to participate firsthand. We set out in 2009 in the fall. This was my first cruise as a graduate student at Woods Hole MIT Joint Program. And what we did is it's a 100-kilometer long ridge. So in theory, there was one vent there, if you look at kind of average vent coverage over the world. And so we gridded it out, sort of like playing Battleship. Like you make a dot every 10 kilometers and you space that out along the ridge. And then we set out with a towed sensor behind the ship. And
what is it sensing?
It's sensing chemical signals in the water that are indicative of a seafloor vent source.
Okay. So just changes in the kinds of minerals that are actually in the water.
Yes, changes in the minerals and also in the light transmittance through water. Vents have a lot of particles in them. And so we can look for cloudiness of the water as well. And in addition to the towed sensor, we were using a very new autonomous vehicle developed by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution called Nereus. And this was Nereus's first cruise as a free-swimming autonomous vehicle. So we were using that to sniff out chemical signals as well.
So what do you program it to do? I mean, does it, when you put a robot down to go sniffing for a vent, do you have it just swim in a straight line, or is it zigzagging back and forth? Or
It depends on what the goal is. We have it do transects, so that would be like more of a straight line approach. And then other times we are narrowing in on a target. First, we'll narrow in using the CAST sensor that's doing full water profiles. And then once we think we're homing in, then we would program the submarine to, you know, trace a path, kind of like mowing the lawn, back and forth, making a grid over an area, and also sort of yo-yoing up and down through, in a small area of the water column to see if they can actually hone in very closely on where that chemical signal is getting stronger.
Now, I mean, we've all followed this recent search for the Malaysian Airlines flight, and I think learned a lesson about how hard it can be to find something in the deep sea when you don't know where it is. What kind of chance of success did you go out thinking that you had when you went out searching for these hydrothermal vents? I mean, you didn't even know for sure that there were hydrothermal vents here.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I always kind of approach my life with the hope that it's going to work. And we had some preliminary data from Alvin dives in the 1970s, which had turned up hydrothermally altered rock materials. And so we knew at least at some point in the past there was hydrothermal activity that was active at the Mid-Cayman Rise. And, we found vent systems before. The chief PI on this project is Christopher German, who has also located vents on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, for example, in the past 10 years. So I've been learning a lot from him about the kind of systematic approach you need to locate something like this. But it actually did take us 3 years from the time we set out to look for them and the time we were actually, had vent fluid samples in hand.
Now, you ended up finding two in an area where just statistically you would have expected one. Now, that could just be an anomaly. But is there a chance that we are globally underestimating how many hydrothermal vents are out there? Have we even done enough searching to know?
Oh, yeah. There are many more out there to find. And there are vents, certain vents are easier to find than others, I guess you'd say. And the classic type of hydrothermal system that you might think of is something called the black smoker vent. These look like these huge, billowing, very dark colored, very mineral and chemical rich. And it's very obviously visual. And it turns out these types of vents are kind of what we've looked for classically using the types of sensor packages we had. We had, this sensor that measured particles in the water. And then in the last decade or so, we've also discovered these new types of vents, which are translucent. They do not have as many particles dissolved in them. And so that type of approach is less successful in even detecting that type of vent. And so one of the new approaches we brought to Cayman was we actually had scientists on board the ship measuring methane in dissolved, which is a dissolved chemical, which is indicative of a vent on the seafloor. But it's not, we do not yet have a sensor that can detect such low levels of methane. And so there is value as well to putting out a scientist on board the ship. And that is what enabled us to discover the second vent site.
Because it's not one of those black smokers.
Because it's not one of those black smokers, and it did not have the particle signal.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with oceanography PhD candidate Jill McDermott about her studies of deep sea hydrothermal vents. Now, Jill, I want to kind of fast forward. A few weeks ago, there was kind of a splash. You were involved in a study with a postdoctoral researcher and your supervisor at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution looking at the water chemistry that goes on at these hydrothermal vents and trying to actually test more scientifically and more quantitatively the theory that's been out there for a while that hydrothermal vents could have been a place where life on Earth, the very first life, the very first cells could have been forming. So can you tell us a little bit about why hydrothermal vents, first of all, might be a good place for life to start?
Sure. Yeah, this project was conceived by Dr. Owen Reeves during his PhD thesis in the joint program in oceanography, where I'm now a student. And the idea behind this is that there's a possibility that the simple metabolic reactions, which now fuel life, could have begun as pure chemistry. So pure chemistry in the absence of life near ancient hot springs. And the focus of this work is a particular molecule called methane thiol. Methane thiol is a small organosulfur molecule, so it contains equal parts sulfur and carbon. And you're probably familiar with molecules like this. There's ethane thiol, for example, which is added to natural gas.
So that's what gives you the natural gas smell.
Gives you that kind of dangerous smell, you know,
right,
when you've left the gas on.
The methane, that's the actual fuel you're using there, it doesn't smell at all.
Itself is odorless, correct.
Right.
Yeah. So, and methane thiol is a very closely related compound. It's what you smell when you eat a meal of asparagus and you use the restroom. That's methane thiol. And that's what our lab smells like. Not all the time. And methane thiol itself is not life, but you can think of it as the starter dough, or it's a step closer toward life. And the reason for that is once you have methane thiol, you have the possibility to make a molecule that's called acetyl-CoA. It's a coenzyme which is found in nearly every living organism, including humans. And because it's present in so many organisms, one theory is that methane thiol could have been this very important spark for early life.
So the idea would basically be that if you have enough of this chemical hanging around, at some point you might start to get chemical reactions that, if they were somehow encapsulated, would basically be the biochemistry, the metabolism of an actual cell.
Yeah, yeah, that's the idea. And so scientists thought, okay, where are we going to find a molecule like this? And then they immediately thought of deep sea hydrothermal vents. And the reason for that is vents are always rich in a few important chemicals, and those are carbon dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, and hydrogen. They're all dissolved gases. And if you have these compounds in a vent, then in theory, you should be able to make methane thiol. We've showed this through theory and through laboratory experiments.
And you were also talking about the fact that at this one Cayman vent and the vents that are not black smokers, that you do see methane as well.
Yes.
Presumably that would help you get to methane thiol as just
a
modified version of that.
Yeah, methane is also an important substrate for microbial metabolisms. It's not directly involved with synthesis of methane thiol. It can actually kind of go between methane thiol and methane. Yeah. And as you were saying, vents are also just in general a good kind of place to look for the origins of life, because you can actually enclose these little pockets of, you know, pre-metabolism compounds. And that's kind of this idea.
You enclose them in what?
In mineral structures.
Uh-huh.
Within the event structures themselves. And so this might be a way to form kind of a protocell, like a little semi-enclosed pocket of materials that could support an early metabolism.
So you guys decided to, you said there was evidence, there was the theory that you could form methane thiol, there was laboratory evidence that you could perhaps form methane thiol under these conditions. You guys decided to actually go and test whether or not there is this chemical at existing vent sites. And you looked at quite a number of them.
Yes, yeah. Our goal was to understand whether or not this molecule can be synthesized in the absence of life in these modern-day systems. And so when I met him, Dr. Reeves had been conducting this worldwide survey of different types of hydrothermal systems. And the question was, how much methane thiol is there and how does it relate to the materials from which it should be made? How much is there relative to carbon dioxide, for example? And what he'd been finding in the black smoker systems was actually sort of somewhat disappointing. There was less methane thiol there in those systems than there should have been. And I came on this project in the Mid-Cayman Rise. We started measuring these vents. And this is actually kind of a fun measurement to make. That, you know, the process that goes into it is you send a submersible down to the seafloor, collect a vent, a fluid, bring it back up to the ship. That's when we get it. And we would inject it into this instrument, which separates out gases according to the size of the molecule. And what you'd be observing is this little line on a computer. And the line is flat. And the line is also moving in time. And the time relates to the size of the molecule. Okay. So now we're measuring methane thiol, and we know, you know, methane thiol is a certain size. So there's a time when methane thiol is going to come out of the instrument. But we don't know how much is there. It's a brand new measurement. And the line is flat.
I mean, you've got suspense. You know when this is going to show up.
We know when it's going to come out at 16 minutes. So you have 16 minutes to wait. The line is flat. And then here it comes. It starts growing. And what it looks like is just this sharp rise in the line. But you also, and so it's this kind of game, like, when's it going to flatten out? And when are we going to know approximately how much is there? And it came and the line kept going. It was higher than anything we'd ever seen. And we were leaping and jumping around the lab. It's like already there was a really cool story to tell.
So the short version of the story that's kind of been told for the public is that in doing this worldwide survey, in most cases, the levels of methane thiol are much lower, and it doesn't seem like hydrothermal vents are as good a candidate as we previously thought for the origin of life. But then you're talking about one or two particular vents where the levels are very high. So what is the more nuanced story there? Are there certain vents that are still very good candidates for the origins of life?
Well, our interpretation of this is that these vents where it's very high, it turns out these are mixtures. So when you have a black smoker, very hot fluid, and it's rising to the seafloor, there's a lot of fractures in this rock. And so there's the opportunity to mix in seawater and create these kind of environments which are cooler temperature, and they're actually able to support life. And these are focus of research for microbiologists. These are host very productive, very interesting microbial communities. And what we now think is that we actually have evidence for cooking life in the subsurface of the Earth's crust. There's actually been organic molecules there that have formed as, you know, as a consequence of life. And methane thiol is actually the breakdown of that life.
So this is now, you're not talking about the methane thiol being abiotic or prebiotic, just pure chemistry. It's actually somehow related to the life.
Yes. What we're finding is that we only really see high methane thiol in environments that do have life. And so going forward, one of the kind of neat spinoff ideas is we may be able to use it as a biomarker to look for life elsewhere in other environments, even in elsewhere in the solar system. Because it has such a characteristic spectrum, it would be a fairly easy molecule to detect on an orbiter, for example, orbiting another moon. And what we've seen so far on Earth is that methane thiol does not come unless there's life present. And so this might be a way that we can detect life elsewhere.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is PhD candidate Jill McDermott. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about Jill's early decision to pursue science and what it feels like to visit the seafloor. Stay with us. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with Jill McDermott. She's a graduate student in the MIT Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Joint Program in Oceanography. She's studying the chemistry of deep-sea hydrothermal vents. It's a passion she discovered while working on a master's degree at University of New Hampshire, but she'd long known she'd wanted to be a scientist. Jill McDermott, you grew up in Madawaska, Maine, the northernmost town in the eastern United States. Nowhere close to the ocean, for one. But what were your parents doing in Madawaska? What was your family doing in Madawaska, Maine? And what was it like to grow up there?
Well, my father is from there, and my dad works as a chemist in a paper mill, which is the main economy in the town. My mother is a science teacher, and she met my father in college. And, you know, northern Maine is, it's not like the rest of Maine. We don't have an ocean. And growing up there as a kid, especially before the internet, is a lot like living in a very remote place. And, what I did mostly is just run around outside. My father and mother planted a tree farm. When I was a kid, we had a 40-acre tree farm. And so I had, you know, we have all of our own land, and I would actually get kicked out of the house for reading too much by my dad.
A problem many parents wish they had, I'm sure.
He would tell me, you know, quit reading, you're going to get weird. Go outside and play. And so I grew up with two younger brothers, and we played outside a lot. There's a lot of focus on the outdoors. My parents are both very big outdoorsmen. We hunt and fish and spend a lot of time outside.
Now, clearly, you kind of had science in your blood. Your father was a chemist. Your mom was a science teacher. At what age did you first think, hey, maybe science is something I'd like to think about doing as a career?
You know, very early, I loved the natural world. My mother would bring home pond water, and we would look at that with the microscope because she was a science teacher and she was planning this, these projects. But I really actually think I made that decision when I changed high schools, and I left my local high school and started attending the Maine School of Science Mathematics, which is a public charter school located in Limestone, Maine. And that school, although it's focused very heavily on science and math curricula, also has other, you know, a well-balanced curriculum. And that's where I first encountered, science and math teachers who deeply loved what they were doing. And they just loved teaching.
So what drove that change of high school? And I mean, how far from home are you talking about being for high school?
I was actually fairly close to home, which was rare because most people are not from where I'm from. The high school is about an hour south of my house, but it is a boarding school. So everybody lives at the high school. Most of my new peers were living in southern Maine. And so most people commuted north, whereas I was commuting south. And I was just looking for more challenge. And I think that high school, being in that environment with all these students from elsewhere in the state, really broadened my perspective, because the community there was much more diverse than what I'd been exposed to at that point.
And by the time you got to college, you went to Dartmouth College. Had you already decided that of all the sciences, chemistry was what you really wanted to focus on?
Yeah. And that was partly because I was proud of chemistry. I thought it was hard. I was probably actually very good at writing and very good at art. Those were my strengths. And my strength certainly at the beginning wasn't chemistry. But I just thought it was, you know, I loved a challenge. And I thought the idea of being a chemist was just, I was something I was not giving up. And so when I went to college, I sort of didn't choose at first. I studied both chemistry and studio art in tandem, and wound up ultimately choosing the chemistry degree, which I'm glad I did. And then I also kind of complemented that by making art along the way.
So why did you, was it purely just to be proud of conquering that challenge?
Well, it was also this interest in the natural world. And I hope with my life that I'll be able to further human understanding of just some tiny fraction of what we don't know.
Now, you then went from Dartmouth to the University of New Hampshire for a master's degree and worked with Karen Von Dam, mm-hmm. one of your mentors and a renowned ocean scientist. What, again, you'd chosen by that point environmental chemistry. What drew you specifically to hydrothermal vents?
Well, I'd seen a picture of Karen on the University of New Hampshire website, and she was at the beach holding this cool-looking rock, which turned out to be a hydrothermal rock. I didn't know that at the time. And I saw this woman just, like, laughing with this rock, and I thought, she looks really interesting. And I'd never really seen a scientist in that generation who was, looked so exciting. And then I read more about her. I found out that it was really important for her to have her students dive in Alvin, which is a manned submarine, or manned research submarine. And I thought, well, it's worth a try. And so I wrote to her, and she pulled my application out of this pile, and she called me up. And as it turned out, I got really lucky. And the system that Karen was studying, or had been studying for 10 years, is called the East Pacific Rise. And it's different than the Cayman system in the sense that it erupts once every 10 years. So very frequently. And the East Pacific Rise had just erupted just as I was finishing my undergraduate degree. And so Karen called me up, and she was in need of more graduate students. So she needed a team of scientists to go out and examine this, the impacts of this new eruption. So I wound up going on my first oceanographic expedition 1 week after I graduated from my undergrad.
And is that when you first got to dive in Alvin?
I did not dive on that cruise. It was a very short kind of surprise cruise. So the National Science Foundation found some money to spend about a week out there. And it was really important at the time that the more senior scientists were diving because they knew the system already. They'd been there before. But 5 months later, we returned on a regularly funded cruise. And that's when I got my first dive.
As you kind of alluded to, Karen Van Dam was known not only for her science, but for her almost fierce advocacy for students and for getting young scientists, students to the bottom of the ocean in Alvin. And I think there's kind of a divide in the oceanography community between those who feel that it is fundamentally important to have human beings present on the seafloor versus those who think that perhaps video from the seafloor to a ship or to a lab back on land is good enough for getting acquainted with it. As someone who had the rare and fabulous experience of getting down to the seafloor very, very early in your scientific career, what kind of impact does that have? Is it purely a personal impact, or is there a really strong scientific argument to be made for putting people on the seafloor?
Well, there's certainly a strong personal impact, and I feel that my dive in Alvin as a 22-year-old, I'm 30 now, and I'm still doing it because I want to go again. But I also feel that there's really important scientific impact, and that is that the human eye, when you're there in person and you're looking out these windows at these black smoker vents, that's what I was observing, it just looks nothing like the camera. And there's no camera that's as good as the human eye. And more importantly, the camera does not know what's interesting. Your brain is getting all this visual information, and it's so much quicker than a camera. And you know immediately, I want to go there, and I want this thing. This is the most important and most interesting part of this environment. And you just don't, I also love working with remotely operated vehicles, robots, and those are also very effective tools for the deep ocean. But the actual visual, more physical sense of being there is very important.
Now, you say that you're still, waiting for another turn to go back down in Alvin. Talk about the emotions. I'm not sure that being on the bottom of the ocean in Alvin is something that everyone would enjoy. What does it feel like emotionally to be a mile or more underneath the ocean, pitch black without your lights, very small vehicle?
It's not something you try to prepare for. The pilots will take you in beforehand just so you're familiar with the space and you understand what your goal is scientifically and how to use the equipment. But when they close the hatch, they're not coming up. even if it's your first dive and you're scared a little bit, they're not, you don't want to not go. And so we play music. We have a CD player, so that's kind of relaxing during the descent. And, it's very safe, has an excellent safety record. So I was just excited. I wanted to be there, and I couldn't believe I got to go. And so, yeah, it's uncomfortable. It's cold. The deep ocean is only 4 degrees Celsius, so you're chilly. So I was wrapped up like a burrito in a wool blanket, and we got about 8 hours bottom time, or 8 hours total in the submarine, about 4 hours bottom time. And my pilot, I got lucky, I got the expedition leader. His name is Pat Hickey, was my first pilot. And he gave me a great first dive. We landed on the seafloor, and then he turned off all the lights.
Again, I'm not sure that's an experience that most people would be smiling the way you are to talk about being a mile under the ocean and now in pitch blackness.
Yeah, and silence. And it's just the darkest dark you've ever seen. And then he blinked the lights, and all the little phosphorescent organisms, there are all these little jellies and tinafores and things, they blink back. It's part of their defense mechanism. So, you're alone there, and it's a very foreign place for a human. But you're also surrounded by life. And, it's kind of like going to space. It's like nobody else really gets to see this. And, it's a privilege to be there. And it's also, there's a whole lot that we need to learn. And I was there after an eruption. Nobody had been to that environment after that eruption before. It was just me. And I'm a brand new scientist, and I, you know, I need to do the best job I can, but, and I've never even been here before. So that feeling was also, I had a huge sense of kind of personal responsibility too. And that kind of calmed me down. I think I was, you know, I was ready. I wanted to take those samples, and, you know, you form a lot of camaraderie with the scientists that are waiting for you up on the ship above the submarine. And so I was thinking of them as well. And
I imagine you form a very strong bond with the people that you're in Alvin with as well. I mean, it's three people who you may not have known each other very well before, and you may say it's only 8 hours together, but it's 8 hours of really being together under this very intense emotional situation.
Yeah, yeah. You put a lot of faith in your pilot, and you know each other a lot better, let's just say, after 8 hours together at the bottom of the ocean. And I dove with a pilot, and then there was one other more senior scientist diving with me. On my first dive, that was Tim Schenk, who's a biologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And that was just, you know, an excellent experience, because I got to hear Tim describing the animals he was seeing as he was looking out. He was diving port on the left side of the submarine. I was starboard, so we each had our own different viewport, and I couldn't see the animals Tim was describing. I could see, you know, similar ones on my side, so I was trying to, you know, imagine, oh, it's a rat tail. I wonder what that is, without interrupting him, because he was taking all these careful notes and observations. But, you know, it was here's an expert on deep sea organisms, and I get to spend 8 hours here with him at the bottom of the ocean.
And was there any, I mean, we've talked with Tim Schenk many times before, and he's a very personable person, and again, another one of these people who is an incredible educator and advocate for students. Was there an intimidation factor, though, that you were 5 months into your master's degree and in Alvin with this expert?
No. No, Tim is so nice. It was actually funny. Some of the other scientists were asking me, are you intimidated? Do you know where you are? And no, I felt welcomed. And, you know, I felt like I could do it. And Tim was, you know, Tim never gave me any other impression that I was more than welcome to be in that submarine.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Jill McDermott, a graduate student at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We'll talk about the choice Jill made between art and science and the challenges she faces as a woman in science after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with oceanography PhD candidate Jill McDermott. She was part of the team that discovered the deepest known hydrothermal vents and also one of three authors of a recent study casting doubt on the idea that such places in the deep sea could have been where life on Earth originated. Interestingly, Jill McDermott says what she's best at, perhaps, in life is drawing. Now, Jill, we were just talking about the emotions and the experience of diving to the seafloor. And a couple of years ago, you were involved in a project called Synergy, which paired scientists from Woods Hole with artists from around New England to produce science-inspired works of art. And you worked with a painter. And the paintings that came out of that, really, they're stunning paintings. They really seem to be more about the emotion of being on the deep sea than what the vista might be at the seafloor. How did that relationship evolve, and how did those paintings evolve?
Yeah, the Synergy project is a project that was launched by one of my co-students, who's Dr. Whitney Bernstein and her colleague Lizzie Kripke. And I worked with Brian McFarlane, who's a professional painter. And, you know, I'm artistically inclined, and I study a very beautiful part of the world. These hydrothermal landscapes are very complex and beautiful, but one of the, you know, challenges for me when I look at a hydrothermal vent is I see chemistry and I see biology, and I want to sample it, and I can't wait to get that up on the ship. But I do not, you know, I can't see, and I have emotions about it, but I don't really, it's hard for me to figure out a way to convey that emotion in a way that's better than the reality, you know. Aside from a picture or a high-definition video, the video is gorgeous. But, you know, video, it's so literal. It's so, you know, It's so concrete.
And
so,
as you were saying, the camera can't pick out what are the interesting things or what are the parts of that picture that perhaps inspire the most excitement or emotion for you.
Yeah, exactly. The camera is just recording literally exactly what is there. And so when I met Brian, we clicked immediately. We were actually late for lunch. We were supposed to rejoin the rest of the artists and scientists, but I was showing him around the lab and showing him artifacts from the deep ocean, and he was just excited. He wanted to hear all about it. What was it like to be there, and how did I feel about my work? And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that on a daily basis. Usually I'm worried about how much propane is in this water. And so talking to Brian was just like a huge relief. And then he, not only that, he went on to make these beautiful paintings that, yeah, it's so flattering to think that I inspired some part of that painting. And he took these ideas and these emotions of being in the deep ocean and then translated this into these, they're like these abstract kind of color fields. And the deep ocean is blue, mostly. There are red tube worms, but the main color you see if you're using a camera is blue, and that's because of the way light absorbs. But Brian brought in all the colors. You know, these paintings are just, they're so neat, and they also capture some of the kind of planetary aspects that I feel inside as I'm observing an extreme environment on our planet. And I think he really brought that into his work as well, this idea of a landscape that has such extreme life that's present.
Did you think going into that what you were going to be trying to explain to this artist was the concepts in your science and your scientific findings? Did you think you were going to be talking about your emotional connection to your work?
No. No, I didn't really. I thought I'd be describing, okay, this is how I planned my thesis, and these are the compounds I was trying to measure. But Brian didn't really want to hear about this. Well, he did. He was really obliging, but he was really interested in what did it mean to me emotionally as a person to be there. And what he actually was really interested in what you can't see. So one thing that's interesting about working with a submarine is if, you know, you're really limited to the field of view directly in the beam of the light. And even just beyond that, it's black. It's just total black. And so you could be easily missing something that's just out of view. And Brian thought this was a really interesting concept, is both what is there and what is just out of view that you're not going to see.
Now, you yourself, as you said, at Dartmouth, essentially almost double majored in chemistry and studio art. And you've said that you think perhaps what you were best at, what came more easily to you, was the art. So, you know, you said you chose science for the challenge of it. But did you really feel that it had to be a choice? I mean, do you still draw and paint, or is that something that you've kind of given up?
Well, I did make a choice. I spend most of my time doing science, and that is, it's still a choice. I'm not, you know, locked into science, but it is what I love, and that's what I want to spend my time doing. That said, I also still draw, and I've recently been making pottery, and I think the reason that is so fun is because when you're making something, a piece of art, there's no predefined way to make a form. For example, I'm trying to make a perfect mug, and somebody has made a mug before, perhaps probably much nicer than mine, but you know, I'm exploring and I'm examining how far can I take this creation until it collapses and I ruin it. And that kind of creative approach is really important for science as well, for, you know, the type of innovation that you need in order to push the boundaries of what we know. Is you need to know, okay, how far can I push this? Can I make this a little differently than what somebody's done before? And it's this historical perspective as well, which I think is also a lot of art is historically people who have solved problems using paint, for example, or drawing things the best way or a new way. And that's a similar approach that I take with my science. And so, yeah, I spend 90% of my time doing science, but I also think the creative part of my brain really enjoys still making art, still making that perfect mug.
Before the Synergy Project, had it ever occurred to you to try to portray your science in an artistic form?
You know, I tried. I tried drawing my vent systems. And of course, I was working from photograph or from film, and I just couldn't do it. I have a huge emotional attachment to this place. It's my favorite place on earth, but I couldn't draw it. I couldn't do it myself. And so the Synergy project was great because I could collaborate with a professional who had the skills and the kind of perspective it took to really capture the emotion of the place.
Now, on a different note here, your mentor at University of New Hampshire was Karen Von Dam. You have also worked side by side with Cindy Vandover. These are some of the most respected and well-known women in oceanography, particularly of their generation. Did you ever speak with them about the challenges that women face in science, or in having these strong female mentors? Was that simply an unspoken encouragement that this is possible and doable?
Well, yeah, I have worked very closely with both Karen and Cindy, and I've had excellent conversations with both of them about their experiences, and it was something I was really curious to hear about, and gave me some perspective on how much things have changed and how, things still a male-dominated field. That's very obvious, especially when you're on a research cruise on a ship. The gender balance tend to be skewed toward male. And to work with Karen and Cindy, who they became oceanographers, 20 years ago, when this was even more pronounced and they had even greater challenges. And so some of the stories that they told me is just, it's impressive. It's impressive that they were able to become, the excellent scientists they are. So there's this challenge to overcome. And both of them were just hugely helpful in sharing their kind of their experiences in the past and how those related to any kind of much more minor challenges that I was facing now.
And yet you have still faced situations where some of these perhaps inequalities and in some cases just the logistics of doing ocean science have presented what you felt was an unfair situation.
Well, yeah, I've been on 6 research cruises, so I've been had a huge opportunity to go to sea, but as I was saying, it is still a male-dominated field, and there are logistics about being at sea. You need to share a room with another woman, for example. And so, you need to actually make sure that the gender balance is correct on ships. And I think on a daily, day-to-day basis, I'm not really so aware of my gender or my age when I'm working. I'm a scientist doing science. Although when I'm on a ship and the gender balance is very, male dominated, I am more aware of my age and my gender in a way that's kind of uncomfortable, and you can get past it. I don't mean to say that I think there's a huge place at sea for young women, and we need more young women at sea. And this is why. It's like, as soon as you start changing that gender balance, when you have, high level female PIs or just a mixture that reflects the natural population, then the environment is just more normal. And, everyone can kind of relax more because normally we see half women and half men. And so I think it's not just oceanography. There's still a gender disparity in any geoscience or physical science and engineering. And, there is a huge place for women in these fields. And these are some of the problems that we need to keep working on.
Now, we've talked a lot about your experiences with Alvin, but when you were actually working on the Cayman Rise looking for these new hydrothermal vents, one of the vehicles, the robot that you used was Nereus. And this is a vehicle that can go both either remotely operated or driving on its own completely autonomously. And we just heard a couple of days ago that this vehicle, while working in the very deep sea, actually imploded and has been lost. And in reading the press release, the news about this, I was really struck by the fact that what happened was essentially that a very important piece of equipment failed while out in, three quarters of the way through a mission. But the press release about this reads almost like an obituary, and talking about Nereus's legacy and the fact that despite this crushing loss, this kind of exploration will go on and we will continue. It felt very much like mourning the loss of a person. What is the relationship between researchers and these vehicles? What creates that personality, essentially, for these inanimate objects and drives such a connection that this would feel like almost the loss of a person?
Well, when you're out at sea with Nereus, which I've been on two cruises with Nereus, you're putting all your faith in Nereus and the Nereus team, the people who work with Nereus. And, you know, my science is not possible without this robot. And so we do become attached to it almost as if it's a person. And Nereus was it's a big loss, but on the same hand, it was a huge pioneer for ocean science. This was the first full ocean depth vehicle that could convert between autonomous and free swimming and also do sampling as a remotely operated vehicle. And it's not just about Nereus. It's also about all the people who've worked with Nereus and the team of people that they've taught Nereus to swim. You know, first you need to teach the robot how to swim and how to descend and how to come back to the ship. And because Nereus was such a pioneer, it was also kind of a risky thing. And so we know that every time that you make a deployment in the ocean, it's a harsh environment. It's not friendly. And so, you know, you never know when it's not going to come back. And, But the fact of the matter is, most of the time it comes back. And one of my greatest experiences working with Nereus was we went out with it on our first cruise, as I was speaking about. But we also returned with Nereus last summer to the site, and it's not a person, it's a robot, but it had come so far. You know, not only had we found the vents, but it was sampling vents with the best of them. It was taking samples that are just as good as my JSON samples that were taken with this, you know, much more established submarine. And then not only that, but we'd accidentally had to deploy one of our samplers on the seafloor back in 2009. And we not only finished the science objectives for that dive with Nereus, we sampled the black smokers, the deepest vents on Earth. Then we transited over and actually located that sampler, which had been on the seafloor for 4 years, found it again, picked it up, and now it's back in the lab. So it's like, hooray, Nereus. You did it. And, you know, that's just my personal story. And Nereus's short career has been filled with things like this. And we will be able to rebuild it. And that knowledge that we've learned from Nereus, that is not lost, because that's in the people that build Nereus.
Do you expect to see something like Nereus essentially rebuilt?
Sure. Yeah, I hope so. I know they're working on some other kind of spin-off submarines called the Nereids. And they're still in their planning phases. Some of them have been built, and they are kind of targeted. Some of them are going to be working under ice environments. Another one is going to be a full ocean depth submarine, similar to something like what Nereus was. So every time something like this happens, we learn a lot. And so I can't wait to see what the next form of Nereus looks like.
I've been speaking with Jill McDermott. She's a PhD candidate in the MIT Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Joint Program in Oceanography, studying deep sea hydrothermal vents, the chemistry there, and how that supports life in the deep sea. Jill McDermott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.